Is it working?
Well, yeah.
There we go. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Jim Traynor. I'm a student here in the MBA program. I'm also getting my clinical research doctorate at Drexel. And all of my research over the last 3 years has been with regard to ethical issues at the end of life. So when I found out that our speaker was coming today, I said I would love to introduce her as we have so many shared interests. She's currently a bioethics student at Mount Sinai, graduating in June of next year. Lives in Oregon, one of the most progressive states in the nation with regard to end-of-life issues and legislation, and since 2001 has been doing casework for Compassion and Choices. She's also on the national board there. She's joining us today to speak on Oregon's controversial yet landmark Death with Dignity Act, and it's my pleasure to introduce Ms. Sue Porter.
Thank you. Thank you. Is someone else about to? Okay. It's a pleasure being here, and I'm glad that all of you are here. And what I'd like to do is, I'll do this informally. Normally, when I have done this, it's a little more formal. But since we're all sitting around a table and we have a limited amount of people, we can be very casual about it. Please interrupt me any time that you have a question. So what I'd like to talk to you shortly about today is people's choices or not as they die. At the end of their lives is the question about personal preference, about how someone is going to die. Is it about doctor paternalism? Should the doctor decide how the person's going to die? Is it about medical technology or legal restrictions? Any one of these subjects has volumes written about it. But today, when we talk about death, because we're going to be talking about Oregon's Death with Dignity Law, the emphasis is going to be on terminally ill patients. Terminally ill patients as defined by the law, and actually generally within the medical community. And Jim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because Jim has a lot of medical background, is someone who's been given a prognosis of less than 6 months to live. So if you went to the doctor today and you were told that you had cancer, we technically don't consider it by law in Oregon a terminal illness unless until two doctors say that you have less than 6 months to live. And I'll address that a little more when we talk about the law. I think we can all agree here that nobody chooses to die, and more than that, nobody chooses a bad death. Modern medicine can be a miracle for people who can be saved. People who have birth defects, people who have an illness that's reversible, someone who's in a car accident, a burn victim, war wounds, etc. But at the same time, medical technology can be a curse to people with a fatal illness, people who are being maintained on pills, pumps, and pipes, and would rather not be. Unfortunately, terminally ill patients do not have a choice regarding whether they're going to die. Any patient can refuse treatment. However, that doesn't guarantee them a peaceful, timely, and dignified death. It just says that they're not going to be treated any longer. And except for Oregon, since 1997, and Washington since 2008, these people don't have a choice of how they're going to die. So what kind of bioethical issues arise? Once a terminally ill patient has refused curative treatment, how long should she be medically sustained, and whose decision is it? This person has decided, for whatever reasons, and in Oregon it's a complete, total, autonomous decision. It has to be made by themselves, by the patient themselves. But for whatever personal reason, this person has decided that life has become too unbearable, and she would like to die peacefully on her own terms. So does the application of medical advancement, and especially palliative care, necessarily have to be applied to this person, or can the person decide for themselves? I think we can all agree that suffering takes place on much more than a physical level. It's mental, it's spiritual, it's financial, psychological, it's familial, it's social, it's exponential. And these people have decided that enough is enough and life is not worth living. The state of Oregon has been on the forefront of questioning these complicated personal, moral, medical, legal, bioethical issues. And so since 1997, we have implemented the Death with Dignity Law. So what I'd like to tell you about is how it works, and please interrupt me anytime along the way with questions, because I'd rather you get what you want out of this. A few definitions. We're very particular about calling this physician aid in dying, not assisted suicide. Technically, anyone can argue with us because this is just about vernacular. But the term suicide to us implies violence. It implies a reactionary behavior. It's desperate and not necessarily associated with a terminal illness. So physician-assisted dying, which we refer to actually as PAD, is also to be separated from euthanasia. In PAD, everything has to be self-administered. You make the decision. You have to go through steps legally that reinforce that you've made the decision, that you will self-administer this medication. In euthanasia, someone can do it to you. Someone can give you a shot. Someone can make you die. But it's strictly against the law in Oregon and Washington. It's strictly against the law in most of the world. Most of the world. The term we use when someone has decided to end their life peacefully is hastening. Their death is imminent, and what they are doing is bringing the date forward. The qualification is that you have to be 18 years old, you have to be mentally sound, you have to have a terminal illness, again, a prognosis of less than 6 months to live, as determined by two doctors. And those two doctors in Oregon, and by the way, the law is the same in Washington. Those two doctors are a prescribing physician who writes the prescription, and a consulting physician who agrees with the prognosis.
So, do both signatures need to be reflected on the script that the patient presents to the pharmacy?
No, actually, there's two answers to that. First of all, there's only one doctor who writes the prescription, but both doctors have to complete paperwork that goes to the state. And there's this fluke in the law. Lisa mentions the prescription that the patient presents to the pharmacy. The law doesn't allow the patient to have the prescription in hand. The prescription has to be delivered by hand or by mail by the prescribing physician. And that can be rather onerous. The opposition to the law got that in there to make it a little more difficult. But when you're mailing a prescription, there's always the chance that it doesn't get to the pharmacy, and that has happened. And for the most part, doctors don't want to deliver it. But we do have our hands tied that way.
What would the, someone who has, say, like Lou Gehrig's disease, somebody mm-hmm. who had a disease that was terminal but kind of rendered them incapable of administering medication mm-hmm. to themselves?
With Lou Gehrig's disease, I'm going to get a little ahead of myself here, but with Lou Gehrig's disease, and this question has come up a number of times, even before administrating the medication, there's the problem of communicating that you want it. And all I can tell you is for the number of Lou Gehrig, there's two kinds of Lou Gehrig's disease from what I understand. One of them, you can't talk anymore. The other one, you can't use your arms. And I think that's the simple version. I've had a number of people with Lou Gehrig's or ALS. The ones who could not use their arms, what we did was we placed the medication, and I'll get to the medication in a minute, but it's a liquid that they drink, so we could put it on a tray with a straw, and they could do it that way. And as far as communicating, they were all able to communicate enough, and there's a few of them who had computers. So they were able to type out, but not talk. So I could ask questions and the answer, or they could ask me questions and then I could give them the answers. But in each case, they were able to. I'm not the only one who has had ALS cases, but
can you pre-correct this before 6 months and say when I hit a 6 month prognosis, this is what I want to do?
It's very smart to do that, and we get people who are way before their 6 months, and I tell them, tell your doctor now that this is what you're going to do. It's actually especially important they do it because no doctor and no pharmacy is required by law to partake in death with dignity. So it's very important to find out if your doctor will prescribe. We've had a few instances, I have to tell you, where the doctors have said they will support the patient, and when the time came, they didn't, which is a whole medical ethical issue in itself. So the process is that there is a minimum 15-day window in which the person first gives an oral request to the doctor, and the doctor has to put in their charts that they received the oral request and on what date. And the last step is 15 days later, the same oral request. And in between, they fill out what's called a medical request form, and it's that they sign and two witnesses sign. That's the vanilla, simple answer to this. It's much more complicated. There's very few people who get this done within 15 days, and there are all sorts of complications that arise, such as a doctor saying they're going to prescribe, but then they're not, then they change their mind. Family dynamics, even though the law is not that complicated, it's very complicated to people who are under medication. They're taking notes on the back of an envelope. They have three different caretakers. There can be a lot of miscommunication. So the simple answer is that it really takes more than 15 days. Once they get the medication itself is, there's two choices, but one of them is Nebutal, and it costs now around $3,600, so nobody takes that one. And the other one is Seconal, and Seconal is 100 capsules in which we, the caseworkers, the volunteer caseworkers, we split open, put in a glass, and add 4 to 6 ounces of room temperature water. So the person has to be able to swallow that, and that's another thing that we have to make sure. There are many people at the end of life who cannot swallow that. At the time of their Hastings, most people will let us know. Well, actually, sometimes people will say, I want to take this in May after my granddaughter's wedding. I can't go to the wedding, but I want to see the pictures. And there's a lot of what we call bargaining down. May comes and they say, well, I'm still feeling okay. My grandson's graduating in June and I want to see those pictures. And June comes and they say, well, I'm still feeling okay. So, I mean, we always think this is great news. When someone is finally going to take it, we usually get a call, I'm going to say about 3 days before. There is this precipitous decline that happens all of a sudden. I always tell people that you can take this whenever you want. However, there's going to become a window of time where it's too late. They can't swallow anymore. They're on so much pain medication that they can't make what we would call a rational decision. They can't swallow. So anyway, I emphasize that along the way. So let's say it's the time of hastening, and there are always two of us who go. And the situations vary all over the board. It can be one person and just their relative or caretaker. We ask that at least one other person be there. It can be literally casts of thousands, and there's a ceremony, and there's a music playing, and all sorts of their favorite things. It can be just the family and the person dies literally petting the family dog, or a situation where granddaughter is reading a poem. It's all really peaceful. It's all very dignified. It's all orchestrated by them. I always tell them from the beginning, you are my boss, so you tell me what you want. The age group, I was telling Jim earlier, is, I would say, generally above, our median age is 71. The youngest person who's ever taken is 34, and we've had about three or four people who are 34, and the oldest was 92. When I meet these people, the first thing I say to them on the phone is introduce myself, etc., and make an appointment to see them. Then when I meet them, I always say, I'm Sue Porter. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm sorry for the circumstance. And above a certain age, they really have come to terms with their death. They really will say, Sue, it's fine. You know, I was going to die of something. Below a certain age, and I'm going to say around 65, generally they have not come to terms with their death. And there's a lot of anger, and they're very upset. And even though they have determined that they want this option of death with dignity, to them it's a reluctant option. It's not like other people who just really want to have it. People get the medication, and most of them, 99% of them, use Seconal. And what used to happen, when Seconal cost a lot less, it's about as high as $550 now. When Seconal cost a lot less, it was 10 years ago when I started, it was between $80 and $130, depending on the pharmacist. People would get the medication and they would hold on to it for a long time. And they would say repeatedly, I'm so glad to have this. If and when I'm ever needed, at least I know it's there. I may or may not use it. But now that it's $550, people are not willing, lots of people, not all, but to pay $550 for something that they will not use or might not use. So the process is more of getting the medication when they're sure they're going to use it. And I think that puts kind of a negative edge on it. Once you've paid $550, well, I guess I'd better use it now. I mean, that's a very sad commentary. But there's only one drug company that manufactures it, and they have a monopoly on the price. And we just see it go up and up and up and up. And there's nothing we can do about it. At the time of a hastening, it is really important, again, to make certain that the person has made this decision on their own and that they're not going to change, that they don't want to change their mind. They can. So when I go to a hastening, I ask them twice when I get there and before they take the medication. I ask them two questions, and I make sure that their relatives or other people hear it, that someone hears it. I tell them first, you have the right to change your mind. Would you like to change your mind? And they say no. We've had one person in about 500 change his mind, and he wasn't my patient. And the other question is, can you tell me what the medication is going to do that you're going to be taking? And they usually kind of go in circles. Well, I'm going to sleep a long time, or I know what it's going to do. And I just stay on them until I hear the word death or dying, because I think it's very important that other people hear it. And then what we do is we open the capsules and we mix it with 4 to 6 ounces of water, room temperature water. And when they're ready, and that can be 2 hours from then, it can be right when we finished. People have different ways of doing this, and we will wait as long as they want it. They're our boss. They take, at that point, when I give it to them, I ask them the two questions again. And again, I say, it's not that I forgot your answer, but I just want to hear it once more. Because by that time, everyone's gathered around. And they take the medication. They go into a deep, deep coma within about 2 to 4 minutes. And they will never know what happens after that point. We cannot predict coma till death. We never do. It can be 10 minutes. It can be hours. The median is around 2 hours. But I actually don't even like to tell people that, because when people are in such an emotional state, and you've met with them a number of times, and one time they have their daughter there, the next time they have their nephew there, the next time, whatever, everyone hears something different. And so I really try to avoid that unless someone pinpoints me. One question that comes up, and I'll answer it before it comes up, is, have we ever had an awakening? And the answer is yes. Out of about 500 people now, we've had 3 awakenings. One of them was mine, and I can tell you why. The other two were never figured out. The reason my person awoke is because you do have the option to take it with applesauce. Since this happened, I avoid that like the plague. But another reason I like to avoid applesauce is because you have to take it in 60 to 90 seconds. We don't want anyone to go into a partial coma. We want them to take the whole thing, so that's why we say 60 to 90 seconds. Anyway, this person was taking it in applesauce. He said, and it's true, this tastes of bile. And his wife took some cherry-flavored laxative, quickly dumped it in there, and it changed the whole chemistry. It took him, I'd say, about 25 minutes to go into a coma. I never felt like he was in a deep, deep coma because of certain reasons. I mean, anyway, and there was too much restlessness. And it was on a Sunday morning, and he awoke on Wednesday morning. And he had the choice to take it again, and of course, he chose not to. And he died naturally, I'd say 10 to 12 days later.
So what effect did that have on him once he awoke from taking that medication?
Well, in plain old English, what he said to his family is, "Why the F am I not dead?" And then, so that was on a Wednesday early morning, and they phoned me. Oh, I had been there every day while he was in a coma. I mean, there was nothing I could do except be with the family. And then on Thursday, Nancy, they called and said, "He wants to see you." I said, "Are you sure he wants to see you?" I am not the cause of this, but okay. And so I went there, and I can speak of this freely because it happened in January of 2005, and his widow went public with it in March of 2005, and she signed every release. She wanted the public to know about it. So I can tell you his name was David. And when I got there, I said to him, this time they had a hospital bed in the living room, and I said, "David, what happened? Can you tell me what happened?" And he said, "I saw the Lord, and the Lord said to put it in his hands." And I did ask him, "What was it like?" And he said, "The same thing we've all heard, that he saw bright lights, et cetera." And he didn't seem angry. I will tell all of you that this especially made me sure that I would never, ever tell anyone how long it takes to death, because if I were to predict anyone was going to die within minutes after coma, it would have been David. He was a corpse. There was nothing left of him but a corpse. So anyway, I was so glad that I never said, "Yeah, I think he'll die soon," because obviously he didn't. The law would have allowed him another chance with the medication, but he didn't want it. And I really don't know what happened with the other two. They weren't my cases.
Did they sue?
Pardon me?
Did the other two sue?
Oh, that's a good question. Nobody sues, because first of all, we can't be blamed for how medication. Second of all, guess what? We have no money. That's true. This is a nonprofit. You know, we beg for money. Interestingly, the widow of David, who went public, and this made headline news in March, a few months afterwards, above the fold, a photo of her holding the ashes, the box of ashes. We were wondering if she was going to sue, but what she said was that she just wanted the public to know that this doesn't necessarily work. And at that point, it was the first one that didn't work. And she also supported our organization. She didn't say anything bad. In fact, she said good things, which was a huge relief. On a humorous level, I mean, her family was very, very different, and anything that could go wrong with this family, trust me, did. When you're there for 4 days nonstop, well, let's see, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, well, and then back, everyone's talking to you about everything. The neighbors were there, their friends, etc. But after he awoke, when I was there on a Thursday, his wife and his wife's mother took me aside and said, "Why didn't you ever warn us of this?" And I said, "There was nothing to warn you about. It's never happened." And they said, "If anything bad is going to happen, it happens to our family And I said, then you should have warned me. And they laughed. They had a great sense of humor. Thank goodness. people who are dying do not lose their sense of humor either. It's not a dark, ugly, cynical situation. People are so glad in Oregon to have this opportunity. And they tell you, and their family members tell you repeatedly, I voted for this law, and it's not a dank atmosphere. It really isn't. Yeah.
What's the public opinion nowadays? I mean, back in 97 when it was approved, I think it was approved by 51% of the population. So I'm interested to know how many people have stayed with their original opinion and how many people have changed their minds about the law.
Okay, well, let me tell you, first of all, it was voted into law in 1994. And at that point, and I didn't live in Oregon, but at that point, from what I understand, it won by about 2%. Then the opposition, and the law, death with dignity, was still not implemented. And in 1997, the opposition got it back on the ballot, and it won by a much larger margin. So I think at that point, like 15% or something. As far as public opinion goes, at first we heard a lot, there was a lot of fear about the slippery slope. People are going to move to Oregon for this, which I'll address in a minute, but makes no sense. It will only apply to poor people. People will feel pressured by their families, etc. None of that has come to pass. Those of us who implement it, first of all, make sure that that doesn't. There used to be a lot more protesting at speeches or at you know public discourse, but that doesn't happen anymore. It is not to say that we don't have opposition. We do have opposition. I personally interviewed the president of our opposing organization a few months ago. It was to write a paper, and believe me, they're live and well. But I can't speak for the whole state because we just don't hear it that much.
I was just going to ask if, I know that some people are concerned that people will feel as though that they're a burden to their family, that it's really their moral obligation to not, you know, make their family have to care for them. You've never had that experience? Like, that's never?
Well, no one has ever said it to me, but let me tell you what the reasons are for people taking the medication, what they tell us. So, and this is in order of how often it comes up. Loss of autonomy. I mean, they cannot function on their own anymore. Can't participate in activities. Loss of dignity. Loss of bodily functions, burden on their family, friends, and caretaker, concern about adequate pain control, and the cost of treating the illness. But if you take any one of these or number, because it's always overlaps, it still has to be their decision. I mean, you can say, I'm really, really concerned that this is costing my family hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that still can be your reason. It does not mean that your family is pressuring you to do it.
I think you can speak to this. I think the protocol itself has so many checks and balances within it that the risk of the slippery slope or the role of coercion is certainly mitigated. I believe that a psych consult is ordered on every,
no.
But not a psych eval. They have to be diagnosed as not clinically depressed.
I was talking about that as well. Mm-hmm. There are situations, it sounds like there are situations where you might say, you know, I don't know if this is the appropriate course of action for you right now. Maybe instead you could try, you know.
Okay.
What I mean?
Well, first of all, a doctor is supposed to give them all of their options.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them would be this is not this might not be the proper course for you. You might choose palliative care, etc. As far as psych eval, it's up to the doctor to decide whether the person needs a psych evaluation. I will be really honest with you, this very rarely happens. I know that the people that we work with are so determined. They have this focus and they want to reach it. There is a lot of question about whether from the outside, whether there should be further psych evaluations. Out of all the people I've worked with, I had one person who was sent for a psych evaluation. By my opinion, she didn't need it in the least, but no one's asking me. And I had one person who I thought was totally off his rocket. He was very determined, but I thought his behavior was completely bizarre. And I happened to know what doctor he was going to. And I emailed the doctor in advance, and I said, this is what happened when I met him. I don't know how he's going to be with you, but I would, you know, be very cautious about this person. And when he saw the doctor, he was completely bizarre in a totally different way. The doctor required a psych eval, and the person died within a week or two, so. You know, and the question about depression is, I cannot say that these people are depressed. I mean, the people I've worked are depressed. I think they're realistic. But there's a question between being depressed, being sad, and having depression, too.
Yeah.
So I think that appropriate sadness is fine. I think appropriate being depressed is fine. I can't address the depression because I can truly say I don't see it. And it's not up to me to decide that. It's up to a medical doctor. Out of all the people who get their medication, about 25 to 35% of them never take it. But they're very glad to have had it, and they will tell you along the way, and their family. We have a few trends that are going on. One of them is that people are waiting too long to contact us. And in a way, I give the responsibility to our organization because we need to do better education and better outreach as to what needs to be done. When I meet with someone, they sometimes say, I didn't know this would be so complicated. Or, you know, we're told that Oregon has this law, but no one tells us what we have to go through for it. When they've waited too long, they can't go through the 15-day process, number one. Number two, they're on a lot of medication, and by my evaluation, I can't say that they're thinking clearly. They might be, but I don't know. When they can't answer a question readily, they can't focus, they're partially asleep while you're there. But what happens really is that the family will call you. They'll call us and say, Aunt Mary has always wanted to do this. Can you come out? So I will never, ever, ever not go out and see someone. I also will never tell that patient you don't qualify. The way I personally handle it is I talk with them, with their caregivers, their family who's there, and I tell them that it is a bit of an arduous process, but at the end, what they're going to have to do is swallow 4 to 6 ounces, blah, 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 you know, within 60 to 90 seconds. Are you able to do that now? Can you drink that fast now? And I know that they can't. So you get a bit of the shrugging of the shoulders, etc. And so what I say is, I'm going to be leaving, but later on today or tomorrow, why don't you try that with a glass of water, and your wife can call me, and we'll proceed one way or the other. And invariably, nobody calls me, and 4 or 5 days later, I will call there, and they'll say, she can't do it. But at least, you know, they saw that they couldn't do it. It wasn't someone coming in and saying, bureaucratically, you can't do this. And I think it's a more humane way of handling it.
Sue, are there more states that are considering implementing this law?
Yeah. Montana has, you know the answer to this?
Montana v. Baxter was decided in 2009. So they pretty much, it's like physician-assisted dying is kind of legalized, but there's no framework for how to go about it. I believe no one has actually tried to take advantage of this court case yet. So I guess it's technically legal, but there's no way to know that.
Well, that's right. In 2009, at the end of 2009, I think it was December 31st, Montana is a common law state. So it was in their constitution, something about personal freedom and people being able to make choices, not necessarily about death. And it went through their legislature all the way to their state Supreme Court and was decided in favor. Since then, all of the courts decided in favor all the way. Since then, since 2010, the legislature there's been a move in the legislature to overturn it. So we don't know what the final outcome. Our organization, which is Compassion and Choices National, is very active in Montana trying to protect it. And also in Montana, there's not a 15-day waiting period. Nothing needs to be recorded with the state. It's all between the person and their physician. So it's a totally different process. And we really hope that it will not get overturned. The next other states that are, another state that is considering it is Vermont. What happened in the last election is there was one person running for governor who said he would veto it, another person who said that he would approve it, and the person who said he would approve it won. So we're looking for something to happen in Vermont. There are many states where it will never happen.
Why the Pacific Northwest? Why is that the yes zone?
Why? I don't know. I think Oregon is the first, it is a kind of a progressive state. We had the first bottle law, you know, and what else? We have all vote, mail-in voting, and all of our beaches are public. I think all these things are really good. And I think it's just in the DNA of Oregon to make things happen.
It's just odd that it's Oregon and Washington.
Well, and Oregon and Washington always work closely together. And we still do. Yeah.
More men are taking advantage of this, right?
No. In fact, I meant to address that. It's even. It depends on the state. Maybe you read some statistics where there were a few more men. Another year, it's a few more women, but it's definitely
in terms of getting the prescription and also taking it.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. And on a religious basis, we have people who have no religion at all, people who say they're spiritual, and people who are very religious. It's all over the board.
How does it impact life insurance?
How does it impact what?
Life insurance.
Oh, good question. It goes down on the on the death certificate as that they died of their disease.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. So that would be a consideration if you don't want to deprive your family.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned you have to be over 18 years old in order to qualify. Is there any talk about extending this to terminally ill children under parental permission?
Mm-mm. There's no talk about that.
That's
a good question.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a in the Netherlands, there's a legislation called the Glucksberg rule, which allows actively euthanizing newborns who are deemed stable but not terminal, which is certainly, I never was a big fan of the slippery slope argument, but if there's a slippery slope, that's one of them, so.
In the Netherlands also, the qualification is unbearable life, if your life has become too unbearable, which has nothing, can have nothing to do with illness.
It's the Groningen protocol, correct? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. A few anecdotes. People like to hear them. Sometimes when I'm comfortable with the person, I ask them before they die if they have anything they want to say, if they have any advice on life. And one lady told me to spend all my money, which is not a problem. She had never seen my shoes. Another lady was about to take her medication, and the only people that were there was a hospice. It was actually a hospice volunteer and her husband and me and my colleague. We always go in twos. And I asked her if she wanted more time with her husband. You know, we can wait, you know, and she, if there's anything they wanted to talk about. Or, and she said, no, anything I'm going to tell him, he's not going to listen to anyway. Very funny. There's so many situations that I should write them down along the way, but I don't even remember.
How often is the family at in conflict with the person who wants to receive?
You know what? I'm going to just kind of guess at that. I'm going to say about 20% of the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about immediate family who's there. I have been told before, if you call next week and a young man answers the phone, don't leave a message. That's our son. He's here from Iowa, and he doesn't know we're doing this. I've also gone to hastenings where someone will meet me at the door and say, her cousin is here. Her cousin and cousin's husband don't believe in this, but they're here, and they're not going to protest. I do know that a few of my colleagues have been in situations where family did protest, which would be very difficult.
So what do you do in that situation? What's your protocol?
I don't know what I would do. I think I would probably say, we don't have any specific protocol, but I think I would probably say, this decision is up to your aunt. We're here. She is who I'm working with today. If it's something that you don't approve, you want to wait outside and we'll let you back in after she takes the medication, you can do what you want, but I'm not going to stop her wishes.
Mm-hmm. Did the families generally stay there for the entire coma period? That sounds tough.
Yeah, they do.
And ultimately, ultimately, who is it that pronounces death? Is it you?
We pronounce it. About 90-95% of our people are on hospice, thank goodness, because when we pronounce them dead, we can call hospice. Hospice calls the mortician. Mm-hmm. And there's no suspicion about the death. If we call, there can be suspicion. Not because they know who we are, because it's so confidential. I would never call a funeral home and say, hi, I'm Sue Porter with Compassion and Choices. What I have done is say, I'm a friend of the family, and so-and-so just died, and they've made their arrangements with you.
Sue, are there many doctors and pharmacies in Oregon or that you know of in Washington that don't cooperate?
Oh, most of them don't.
Most doctors do not.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you have essentially a list of doctors who do, or you're...
Well, hopefully the person is already going to a doctor who is partaking. The doctors that we work with are neurologists, oncologists, pulmonologists, general practitioners, interns. I mean, obviously, we're not working with dermatologists and podiatrists.
Right.
Anyway, that's about it. And the numbers of doctors participating has definitely increased, and I think that's because everyone sees that it works. They're not as afraid anymore to be involved. We have a medical director, and if someone is in a desperate situation, we actually have two now. She or he will contact doctors and see if this patient can change doctors. Mm. But one thing we do not want is people moving to Oregon for this, because guess what? They don't have two doctors. And we're not going to be in a position of calling doctors and say, so-and-so just moved here from New Mexico. Will you write them a prescription? I mean, that would be so far out of our range.
Isn't it a pretty common occurrence kind of in all states that say if I'm a terminal cancer patient and I am in pain, that the doctor continues to increase, say, like the amount of morphine until it gets to a level where I'm still in pain, but if you give me any more, it would stop my respiration and I would die.
Double effect. Why don't you address that?
That's the rule of double effect. And in 1997, there were two court cases that made palliative sedation, which is what you're speaking of, you know, a legal right. And there's two types. There's proportionate palliative sedation, where you're just increasing it until the symptoms are alleviated. And then more controversial is palliative sedation to unconsciousness, mm-hmm. where that patient's given a large bolus and maintained in unconscious state until they pass. Mm-hmm. And in those instances, its difficulty is with prognostication. Again, those patients should not have a life expectancy of greater than 2 weeks, mm-hmm. because all other life support measures are taken off, even artificial nutrition and hydration. Mm-hmm. So.
But you know, where I live, they don't admit to double effect.
But they do it all the time.
Oh, I'm sure they do it all the time. We all know they do it all the time.
Yeah, we've almost all of us have witnessed it.
I often wonder if the same doctors who are doing double effect are the same ones who refuse to write the prescription.
Right. Or if it would just be the ones in Pennsylvania who would write the prescription if it were a legal option.
Yeah.
I think the actual numbers are much higher than what's reported.
Yeah.
Oh, I
do. Do you have any idea what that might be?
I don't.
Oh, I do too. I agree with you.
Yeah, I would expect that too.
I know that when we finish here, I'm going to think of 100 things I forgot to tell you. Does anyone have more questions?
How has the Death with Dignity Act changed how the doctors are trained in medical school in Oregon?
Oh, I don't know. I can't speak for medical schools, but I really, really hope that in medical schools there are more courses being given in bioethics, and that Oregon and Washington law are at least talked about. I hope. Did anyone in this room see it was on PBS a few weeks ago, the documentary called Facing Death? I encourage you all of it to watch it on your computers. I watched it twice, no commercials. PBS, Facing Death. And one problem in the medical community that is so pervasive is that people aren't told that they're going to die. And you'll see this. This takes place at Mount Sinai, a medical center. And personally, I was in a class last summer and did rounds in their medical ICU department, and the doctor who was head of the department said to me and another bioethics student that that person is going to die. He personally is so angry because they were never told, their families were never told, and the way this doctor described it is their doctors kicked the can all the way up to medical ICU. And it's a huge ethical problem, and it's a huge financial problem for our country. Mm-hmm. And I encourage you to watch this, because there is one scenario where you'll see someone asks two doctors, is my brother dying? And even there, and I think he died within days. I mean, you watch it, you know he's dying. The doctors stumbled on their answers. So I hope that in medical school, all these situations are being addressed.
I think with regard to your question, though, the Oregon's Death with Dignity Act caused mass improvements in the area of palliative medicine. Mm-hmm. They have significant gains. And in August of this year, an article came out in New England Journal of Medicine about early palliative care interventions early on in the stage of cancer. And it was very interesting is that the earlier palliative care is consulted, the less likely those patients are going to initiate life-sustaining treatments, which are hugely costly. And even though that's the case, the earlier palliative care is consulted, the longer these patients live.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
With better quality of life. Has a great article called Letting Go that kind of speaks to the same thing about like patients that are on hospice care actually like live up to like 3 weeks longer than those in the ICU, and just what a better setting it is for families and patients.
And I think the biggest fear with patients with terminal illness, it's not the dying, it's the pain that they're going to endure. Mm-hmm. And they've made peace with the dying, and that's okay because we're all mortal, but it's living with the pain that they're so most in fear of. And in initiating palliative care early on, and I see that with the cancer patients that I manage their diagnostic treatments, the sooner they do that, they feel like they're in control and they're on top of it, and they, you know, they're in tune with their bodies, and they're really listening to what's going on with themselves, and they kind of take control in an uncontrollable situation. That what Sue does also gives them that control, their final control at the very, very end. Yeah. You know, when nothing else is going to really bring them.
And it being framed as a battle, like a medical battle, so like beat cancer, beat whatever, I think is also really problematic because I think a lot of people just have a hard time talking to your organization because like you're giving in and you're not trying hard enough.
Exactly.
And I think that that's just like a societal issue that we really
It is, to. And I did a paper on this when I was doing my studies at Villanova. I wrote a paper on physicians being the gatekeepers to palliative care and hospice. And most doctors are not willing to have that talk with their patients, mm-hmm. and saying, listen, this cancer is terminal, this disease is terminal, you are going to die from this. They feel like they're kind of giving up on their patients.
It's a failure, right.
You know, that they failed their patients, but in fact is that they can, and I can't treat you anymore, but they can still treat them. They can treat them with palliative care. And I see in the hospice movement, Wissahickon Hospice that works through Penn, a lot of the patients are now being given this information early on in their care. I know our oncology department at Penn will give them this information. You know, this is something for you to think about. This is something that, you know, in addition to your chemo treatment, consider this because this is something that will help you when the pain starts to get to be too much for you to bear. We can manage that. We can help you spiritually, mm-hmm. social-wise. We can.
So there are options.
So there are a lot of options
and,
out there.
Yeah. And so what I would just like to just end this, unless there are more questions. Okay. So what compromises life and who determines its quality and its purpose varies from individual to individual. Illness that previously led to a natural death are now, as we all know, indeterminately prolonged. But are we extending life or are we protracting death? Through medical mechanization, blood can keep flowing, lungs keep breathing, hearts keep pumping, blood pressure is maintained. And this all results in a suspended kind of existence, but is this life and who decides it? So I think from a bioethical issue, that's what we all have to keep thinking of, what would be best for you and how you can take control of it. I always like to end these by saying it's not a cliche that each day is a gift because it is. So thank you. Thank you for taking an hour and coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Two things I want to tell you real quickly is, unfortunately, in most nursing homes, assisted living places in Oregon, it's illegal that HB.